going to pick up where we left off. You'll remember, which is at the beginning of the Seleucid domination of Palestine, Transjordan. Might review just for a minute, and especially for some of you who weren't here last session, is to remind you that in 332, Alexander the Great takes over Syria, Palestine, and Egypt, so the period of Persian domination comes to an end at that time. Alexander dies a few years after that, and his kingdom, the Hellenistic kingdom, is divided among his generals, with two generals being important for this area, Seleucus, who dominated and established the Seleucid kingdom in Mesopotamia and Syria, with two capitals, one Seleucid near ancient Babylon on the Tigris, and the other one being Antioch on the Phoenician coast. North of the northern border of Syria today. Ptolemy established his kingdom primarily in Egypt, although the original agreement was that Palestine Transjordan would be controlled by the Seleucids. Ptolemy at the last minute was able to outmaneuver Seleucus and gain control of Palestine. And for the next 100 years, although the Ptolemaic rulers were dominating this area, Palestine, Transjordan continued to be disputed territory. That is, the Seleucids felt they had a claim to it, even though it was under the control of the Ptolemaic. Ptolemaic taxation of the region was fairly rigorous. On the other hand, it appears that most of the people here went along with the system. They seem to have maintained the Persian system of hiring out or letting out the tax system to the highest bidder, so that if you wanted to be the tax collector, you could offer a certain amount to the government, and as long as you supplied that annual amount, you could extract as much taxes from the local population as possible. The Tobiah family out here at Iraq al-Amir appears to have been the tax collectors for the Persians, and it appears very likely that that family line continued to collect taxes for the Ptolemaic rulers. I mentioned also last time that there was a rather intensive attempt to Hellenize the area, that is, to promote Greek culture, manners, religion, and so forth. The Decapolis cities were established at this time as centers of Greek culture. We don't know exactly when, but certainly during the Ptolemaic period, and they will flourish under the Seleucid period to follow. Hellenization and the presence of the Decapolis cities was a sore spot to the more conservative religious groups. Certainly we know from the biblical text for the conservative Jews. And during this time there was then a growth of, you might say, hard-line conservatism mingled with nationalism, as the Jews in Palestine began to have hopes of the restoration of the former glory of the Davidic and Solomon empires. Between 200 and 198, the Seleucids attacked the Ptolemies and were able to take over domination of Palestine and Transjordan. This, probably shortly following that, seems to have been the death blow for the folks out here in Iraq al-Amir. The so-called Qasr has been dated to around 175, maybe a little bit earlier, 185 BC. There is evidence that Francois Rocher, the French fellow who's been working there, has at least some fragmentary evidence that shows that John, or Hyrcanus, the son of Joseph, who built the thing, was aligned with the Ptolemaic rulers. If you approach the castle itself, you'll see a reconstructed eagle, which of course was the symbol of the Ptolemies, right at the visited the site himself. He refers to it fairly accurately in describing the time, but also refers to it as a fort, where in fact it appears more likely to be some kind of palace or a temple. It's interesting, when the Seleucids came into Jerusalem, evidently the Jews, right before the arrival of Antiochus the Third, who was the Seleucid ruler that defeated the Ptolemies. As he was approaching, the Jews in Jerusalem rebelled against the Ptolemies, so that the capture of the city of Jerusalem by the Seleucids was a very easy affair. In response to that, and evidently Antiochus the Third was greeted with a very friendly greeting from the peasants of Jerusalem. The Seleucid ruler made provisions for several years that the country would not be taxed in order to allow them to make it economic. Evidently, the Ptolemies were taxing the country more heavily every year, and that certainly was one of the reasons that they welcomed the Seleucid invaders and liberators rather than going to conquer. In 192, actually, following the time of the invasion, 198, and 192, during that period, Antiochus was able to take over most of Turkey, was expanding his boundaries, became very ambitious, invaded Greece in 192, and when he made that move, at that point, the Romans declared war on the Seleucid kingdom, and fairly quickly drew Antiochus back into Asia Minor, pursued him in 190 BC, defeated him. And that defeat in 190 by the Romans, in a sense, marks the end, or at least the decline, the beginning of the end for the Seleucid kingdom. Peace treaties were very humiliating. There was a heavy annual tribute that was extracted by the Romans from Antiochus III. And just to make sure that Antiochus lived by the conditions of the treaty, 20 members of his family were taken into exile in Rome. So that if he withheld tribute, then they would have been persecuted if not killed. From that point on, you find the Seleucid rulers running around doing everything they can to raise the money in order to pay off the Romans each year. And in fact, in 187, Antiochus himself was killed while he was in the process of robbing the temple at Elim. Certainly, if you read some of the intertestamental books, like the Book of Maccabees, they're very harsh on the Seleucids because of their sacrilegious practices. One of the reasons probably was for the looting of all these temples and so forth, just to raise the money. On the other hand, certainly the local religious folks were very disturbed by what followed. After about 12 years of rule by Seleucus II, Antiochus IV came on the scene. And Antiochus IV initially was not too bad, although he did carry this practice of Hellenization further than any of the rulers, any of the Seleucid or Ptolemaic rulers before him. He was very concerned to press Hellenization in the area. And I think we have to be a little bit careful there. Again, some of the intertestamental books, like the Book of Maccabees, present the fellow like Antiochus as being Satan incarnate, almost. In fact, he did take the title Epiphanes, Antiochus Epiphanes, which means God present or the appearance of God. He did consider himself the incarnation of Zeus. But whether the repressive measures he took against the Jews and the positive steps he took towards Hellenization was really out of a religious motivation. I'm a little doubtful about that. I think one of the reasons that all of these folks were interested in promoting Hellenization was not because they believed that the Greek gods were the only true gods, but it was kind of a universal approach by identifying the various gods with the Greek pantheon and by promoting Greek culture. What they were trying to do really was break down the barriers that divided people and in that sense were a threat to the kingdom. So in a sense, I'm sure that most of your Hellenistic rulers would probably view what they were doing with the spread of Hellenization in the very same way that a lot of us Westerners would say that we're for the promotion of the spread of democracy rather than various victories.
Any other questions?
With the increased impetus that Hellenization was getting from the event of Antiochus, there was also an increased or an intensified reaction among the Jews living in Jerusalem, especially again from the more conservative folks. Open rebellion broke out in certain cases, and in 167, Antiochus came back very strong with very, very repressive measures against the Jewish community. Up until this time, Jews have been allowed to practice their religion without any strictures. At this point, though, suddenly an altar was put up for Zeus in the temple. A statue was put up and an altar put up for the sacrifice of swine in the temple, which, of course, was the absolute worst thing that a good Orthodox Jew would think of. Also, the holy books and writings, religious writings, were burned. It became illegal to observe the annual religious festivals or even keep the Sabbath, as well as circumcision of children suddenly became unlawful, and all of these things were punishable by death. Not only were there certain things that you could not do, but there were certain things that you had to do, such as participate in the Greek Hellenistic sacrificial system, which meant that you had to both sacrifice and eat the meat of the animals that were sacrificed. Again, since that involved pigs, it was very disgusting to most of the people, and it was probably the very, very impressive measures that caused the so-called Maccabean revolt in 167. There's one very important event that I failed to mention, and I want to backtrack this for a minute now. And that is the writing of the Septuagint version of the Old Testament. You'll very often see this abbreviation in especially biblical, scholarly biblical works, LXX, which of course means 70. Around 250 BC, we really don't know exactly when, but right around that period, the Old Testament was translated into Greek by Jews living in Alexandria. These are Jews which had formed a community there following the Babylonian exile. The reason they translated the Old Testament into Greek was because, having lived in Alexandria, which had become a center of Greek culture, they had adopted the Greek language as a common language. Most of them forgot Hebrew and therefore could not read the scriptures. And the same thing happened in Mesopotamia, except everybody there adopted Aramaic. Therefore, much of the Old Testament was also translated into Aramaic, so-called targets. And Hebrew continued to be an ecclesiastical language, but most of the people, if they would read the Old Testament, would be reading the Septuagint. There are a lot of stories and legends behind the creation of the Septuagint. Probably the Pentateuch itself was translated first, and then slowly the other books were translated and compiled. Legend has it, though, that there were 70 scholars involved in the translation of the Septuagint. They all went into independent rooms, made their own translations. They came out and saw miraculously that word for word they all were in agreement. Therefore, it's a certain vindication that the Septuagint translation was inspired, divinely inspired. About 250 BC. Certainly by that time, the Pentateuch had been translated. Again, some of the later writers may have come later. And of course, certain books like Daniel probably had not been produced by that time yet. It is interesting, when we talk about the canon, that since the Reformation, at least in the Protestant churches, usually the Old Testament version of the biblical text that people follow is the Hebrew text. That is, the books that are contained in the Hebrew canon. The Septuagint, on the other hand, has more books in the Old Testament than the old Hebrew scriptures do. And it's interesting today, if you go to a Christian seminary, either Catholic or Protestant, you'll always study the Old Testament in the old Masoretic Hebrew text, not the Septuagint. What's strange about that is that with the rise of Christianity, the early church used the Septuagint almost exclusively. And in fact, if you compare a lot of the biblical quotes in the New Testament with the Hebrew text, you'll find that it very often doesn't jive, because there are differences between the Greek version, the ancient Greek version, and the ancient Hebrew version. So it's kind of interesting, the Christian church has kind of gotten off track, or at least thrown away the Bible of the early church, the Bible certainly that Paul was relying on, and gone back to the Hebrew scriptures, which are actually much later, or at least in the version that we have. Yeah.
Any more?
Yeah, roughly we can say that the Hebrew version of the Bible as it exists today was formed around 90 AD at the Council of Damien. Now, it wasn't as if they had this council and suddenly everybody...
Council of what?
Jamnia.
J-A-M-N-I-A,
I believe. It's not as if these scholars got together and said, okay, we're going to make a Bible. There were certain books that had been in use for a long time. Certainly, there was no question about the questioning the authoritativeness or the inspiration of the Pentateuch or the prophets. There was some debate on the so-called wisdom books. During that time, and actually it's an interesting thing, you find the formation of the canon very often in response to something. Certainly the Hebrew canon was closed because of the rise of Christianity and the Christians using the Septuagint, which the Jews themselves had used. And that's probably at that point because the Jews closed the Hebrew canon and excluded certain books that are in the Septuagint, which Christians were using as verification of the Messianic office of Jesus. Yeah. Which canon are you talking about, though, when he talks about the law? Right. Certainly, there are those three divisions, but again, the Septuagint has the same three divisions. The law, the prophets, and the writings. certainly the appearance of a lot of those books in the intertestamental period also was one of the things that forced the closing of the canon ahead, because a lot of those books were being written in the name of Moses or some of the older people in that literature. I'm sure that they didn't creep into the canon. But it's still very questionable. And at the time of Jesus, since there wasn't really a closed canon, it's difficult to determine if, in fact, Jesus didn't consider some of the, for instance, the books of the Septuagint, which certainly Paul and the leaders of the early church considered all of those books to be canonical books, which today Protestants would be considered apocryphal, certainly those books. I think it's very likely that Jesus also considered some of those books as part of Scripture. But again, I mean, there's no way that you can really decide one way or the other. We do not have a copy of the Bible from that time. Well, the earliest complete copy of the Bible we have in Hebrew comes from about 1100 AD.
Aramaic script.
It's written in an Aramaic script, but it's Hebrew language.
Certain portions.
We've got fragments of that through Dead Sea Scrolls. There are fragments that go back to 300 BC. In Dead Sea, right? Fragments of it. Six are probably learned in the same time. Now, a lot of this is very unclear. I mean, we just don't know exactly when certain sections of the Bible might definitely came to be accepted, or if that ancient version of the Pentateuch was exactly the same we use today, or the synagogue, that may have been pre-exilic. In any case, the production of the Greek Septuagint translation around 250 BC is a very important document, especially for the later Christian church, because of the early Christian church. Okay, back to 167 BC, and in a reaction to the very oppressive, strongly Hellenistic actions of Antiochus Epiphanes and Antiochus IV, a rebellion broke out, a rebellion which really the Seleucids didn't pay any attention to at the beginning. In a little town north of Jerusalem, there was a fellow by the name of Matathias, who was apparently kind of a farmer, priest, religious leader in his village, following the instructions of Antiochus Epiphanes, one of the Syrian soldiers was forcing a Jew to present a sacrifice of a pig. This fellow reacted against that, killed both the Jew who was making the sacrifice and the Syrian soldier, and hightailed it for the hills with his five sons. In the desert, the Judean desert south of Jerusalem, they gathered more and more loyalists and conducted guerrilla warfare against the Seleucids, and were amazingly successful within 2 years. By 165, they had obtained a peace treaty with the Seleucids, had gained control of Jerusalem itself, and in 164 rededicated the temple, which amounted to taking the statue and the altar of Zeus out of the temple, cleaning it up, and reinstituting Yahweh worship in the temple. That particular event is celebrated even today. It took place in what we call the month of December, and that's the origin of the Jewish celebration of Hanukkah. From that point on, from 167 on, there was revolt or military action continued until by around 100 BC, the so-called Maccabean rulers or Hasmonean rulers of Jewish origin were in control, not really of the Davidic borders, but what are often described in the Old Testament as the biblical borders of Israel, that is from Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south. And they also controlled parts of Transjordan. In fact, most of the plateau of Transjordan, although Amman itself was still out of the territory of the Maccabees. The capitalist cities, of course, were a target of the Maccabeans. They were the ones, religious zealots, who wanted to quell the influence of Hellenism, so they occupied places like Jerash, Gadara, and so forth, and tried to suppress the Hellenistic movement. Whereas under the Ptolemies, and especially under the Seleucids, the Jews had been persecuted rather partially. At this point, once they seize power, they turn around and become the persecutors. The Maccabeans or Hasmonean rulers were very ruthless in taking over villages and forcibly making people adopt the Jewish religion on or face death. It's during this time that the Idumeans, and we should probably have mentioned what had happened before, the Ammonite group, or the people that were living here, seemed to have survived all of this change in the Persian period to the Hellenistic period. The Moabites by this time had vanished. We don't know what's happened to them, probably just overrun by Bedouins coming in from the eastern border. The Nabataeans in the meantime had pushed up and occupied the former Edomite territory, and the Edomites had migrated across into the Negev in the southern part of Judah and become known as the Edomians. It was during this Maccabean period that most of the Idumeans were forced to convert to Judaism, and in fact, one of the people that did that was the grandfather of Herod, fellow that later became ruler of Herod the Great. Along with that forcible conversion to Judaism, it appears that there was quite a bit of official corruption within the leadership. The Hasmonean kings also assumed the role as high priest in the temple, and there was often fighting back and forth within the family as to who would control the temple. Because of all the political intrigue, it was during this time, again we don't know exactly when, but sometime during this Maccabean period, that a group split away from the Jerusalem temple and went and founded the community of Qumran. Whereas the Hasmoneans viewed themselves, they had this great messianic expectation, feeling that they were the chosen people that would usher in the kingdom of God. The Qumran sect, on the other hand, had been influenced by the growth of apocalyptic literature and ideas, which had grown up especially during the Seleucid domination, and had come to think that the Messiah will not be as formerly it was an earthly king that will establish military power, but with the Qumran community and other apocalyptically oriented groups, emphasis for the messianic expectation was shifted from a worldly view of what a Messiah was as a king to a more heavenly view, or that the things on earth were so bad that there would never be another David. Now God himself would have to send the divine being as a Messiah in order to save his people. You also find at this point, with the growth of apocalyptic literature, quite a difference in the way prophecy goes. In the Old Testament, the prophets are almost always concerned with events which are immediately upon them. The emphasis is no longer on seeing what immediate political events are going to take place and what the immediate outcome is. Suddenly you're looking way into the future, you're talking about direct divine intervention and the end of the world, or the end of the age, the end of history, a much more universal, cosmological output than and the Old Testament prophets very immediate. As I mentioned, there was a lot of intrigue fighting within the Hasmonean family. I should perhaps point out that one of the most important sites here in Jordan that's built, fortified by the Hasmoneans right around 100 BC when the Hagadah Tower is Mawakar, well, what's known in the Old Testament, or the New Testament, that you'll see Paris. You go through Madaba, further to the south. What's that? Yeah, it's off the Kingsway Highway about 15 kilometers south of Madaba. And then the number. Okay, 21 kilometers into it from the Kingsway Highway.
To the right.
Right.
In other words, west.
West.
Right. Southwest
yes.
of.
Right. Right on the edge of the Yisro. One thing that, unless I'm wrong, I don't think, first of all, Daniel ever uses the word Messiah, which is, he uses that. Does it? Yes, he is. Or is it Son of Man? Yeah, certainly, the book of Daniel is written as if, whatever its date is, written as if it's written during the Babylonian period, and he is referring to Babylonian emperors. Again, that's always just a question. So whether the fact that Babylonian princes are mentioned and that is the setting of the book, if in fact it actually dates to that period. I could write a book myself now and talk about the history of David and Solomon.
Thank you.
think there's some problems with the terminology of Daniel. If you start using these numbers and saying that you can actually take from Daniel the figure that he actually is speaking about the Christ in the world, again, this would be a long conversation about that. Well, I might as well mention one thing before we get into the parable. And this goes back to the influence of our previous one. Raise a few eyebrows, too. Certainly with the Septuagint, not only does the Septuagint become very important theologically in the formation of the early Christian church, but because it is in the Greek language, and certainly by the time of Christ, although that period Rome dominates the area. Greek is the official language of international commerce. Aramaic continues to be the vernacular of most of the people that live in Palestine. And for a couple centuries AD, Greek replaces Aramaic as being the dominant vernacular of people here in Palestine. And during that period, when the Septuagint exercised most of its influence and the Greek language became so important, if you find creeping into Christian theology ideas which are not actually Hebraic in origin but are actually Greek in origin. And one that I would suggest is the whole idea of the soul. Now this is very often a controversial topic. Do you have a question now? Many people, certainly within the Christian tradition, would say that the doctrine of an immortal soul is one of the primary tenets of Christianity. In fact, if you look very carefully at the Old Testament, I think you'll find it impossible to find anywhere in the Old Testament where you have the idea of an immortal soul. According to the Old Testament view of man was mortal. He's made from the dust of the ground, and once he dies, he returns to the ground. Certainly, the early church fathers who were writing in Greek, who were studying Greek philosophy, especially in Alexandria, adopted a lot of Greek ideas. Let's say with Origen, right around 200 AD, was where you really get the idea that there is such a thing as an immortal soul that is trapped in our body for a certain period of time while we're alive, and when we die, soul flies free from this fleshly prison. It's a very Greek idea, and I don't think you can actually find that anywhere in the Old or the New Testament. In the Old Testament, you have the Hebrew word nephesh, which means basically life or breath. And any animal, including man, that breathes has a nephesh. And when you die, your nephesh leaves, not meaning an entity that's inside of you, but just that your breath leaves. One argument, I think maybe the strongest argument, is this one is the idea that Paul had, which the idea against belief in a soul, is if you remember when he goes to Athens, he preached to the people and they were receiving him well, and suddenly he started talking about the resurrection of the body, and people started laughing at him and leaving the audience. The problem is that Paul was speaking to the Greeks about the immortality of the soul and the perishable nature of the body. They have no problem with that. But when he started suggesting that there was a bodily resurrection, which for the Hebrew was the only kind of resurrection that you could have, since a person doesn't have a soul, when you die, you die. But the
do they still believe that?
What's that?
Hebrews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say the majority do. Well, but see, there is no such word as soul in the Old Testament. That's a Greek. When the Septuagint is produced, they translate nephesh as by the Greek word soul, and of course, once you believe that, you throw all the Greek baggage into the Hebrew context. Certainly have it in the context that it's used in the Bible itself, and it does have a variety of meanings. It's used as the breath, sometimes as a throat, sometimes a person, a slave. It was said that Abraham had so many nephishes, meaning so many people.
Warm bodies,
right. Certainly the term is used restricted, not to all animals. Fish don't have nephish. It's only land animals that have lungs that live and breathe that have nephesh. But again, there, I think it's fairly clear from the Old Testament context that the nephesh is related to the breath, and it's not identified as something in and of itself that's separate from the body. And in Greek thought, you can so easily document that is a Greek idea, and it's very much influenced the New Testament Jewish community as well as the New Testament Christian community. But you just cannot find that same idea of a pre-existent soul and a post-existent soul, that is, a soul that goes on after a person dies, in Hebrew thought, as it's found in the Old Testament. The closest you get to it is when Samuel dies. And Saul goes to this witch who conjures up Samuel. Saul, just before the battle of Philistine, Saul talks to Samuel and turns into a big, waking from his sleep. The Hebrews did have the idea of Sheol, the place of the dead, being a place where people go and kind of live a shadowy existence, which is very similar to the view that pervaded throughout Mesopotamia, that there was something that happened after you died, but it certainly wasn't an immortal soul that was freed from the body and went back to God.
I think
that's
a
that's, where the misunderstanding comes, you can see it right in the beginning of Genesis, in the second chapter, where God forms a clay into a man, and says, and he breathes into the man, and the old Septuagint said, and man became a living soul. And King James Version said, and man became a living soul. If you look at the more modern international translation, or RSV, they'll translate that as, and man became a living being, which is a better translation, at least it's a better translation. Why? Just because the idea of soul, when you say soul, we have so many things attached to that kind of idea, and they're Greek in origin. They're not. Again, I'm not saying that necessarily that the belief in an immortal soul is wrong. I'm just saying it's not biblical. And at the point it appears in the New Testament, the reason, again, you get references to a soul is because the New Testament is written in Greek, but there's no Greek word that they use. The word, closest word that they could, or felt that it would work, but it brought in a whole bag load of new ideas that weren't existing. Again, I think if you have in New Testament times the idea of immortality of the soul, the whole doctrine of resurrection of the body, which was what the early church was promoting or preaching, really doesn't make much sense. That's why you need to have a resurrection if, in fact, you have a new soul that is going to go on forever. The real emphasis in the New Testament is that the man is mortal. You die. Therefore, resurrection really meant something to you for the Christian. Because of the very fact that they didn't believe in the human soul. Well, anyway, we should sign off, but I just... Certainly, you can find, because of the Septuagint and because of Hellenism, that there was a great impact on Judaism and Christianity, and certainly on the Hasmoneans, Maccabeans. Although they were reacting against the Hellenistic movement, they were deeply influenced by Hellenism. Just to start off with the Roman period, and say a few words, and then we'll pick up with that next time. The Hasmonean rulers continued to dominate for about 100 years, from 167 BC to 63 BC. By that time, Pompey had come into Syria. There was a squabble going on in Jerusalem between members of the Hasmonean family as to who should take the throne and dominate the church and dominate the country. A call was sent out to Pompey to come to Jerusalem and settle the argument. Actually, not to come to Jerusalem. Both contenders to the throne appealed to Pompey to support them. He ended up coming to Jerusalem, settling the dispute, as you can see on the first page, right at the top of the second page. He decided in favor of a fellow by the name of Hyrcanus. Another very important person who played a very important role in all of this was a fellow by the name of Antipater, who you see as Antipater the governor in 55 BC. It was probably because Antipater had also supported Hyrcanus that Pompey decided to go with him rather than the other side. Antipater was one of the generals of the Hasmonean. Also, just to explain this chart, to the far right, this column that says important rulers, these are the people who immediately ruled over the territory of Palestine during the early Roman period. And of course, Roman emperors were in Rome, but they ultimately had control over the local. So Hyrcanus, although from this period on, from 63 on, then Palestine is under Roman rule, although Hyrcanus, a Hasmonean, continues to sit on the throne and act as more or less a local administrator. Again, there was much unrest in 55 BC, and Antipater, who had been his former general, been very faithful in the service of Rome, was appointed as governor of Palestine. Following his death, and this isn't reflected here, but his son Herod was named to be the governor of the Galilee region. Again, there was a fight against Herod and his brother, who was the governor of Judah. The Nabataeans, the Hasmoneans, and the Parthians got together. The Parthians came down and invaded in 40 BC and put Antigonus on the throne, Antigonus again being a Hasmonean. Herod, at this point, fled to Egypt, was taken care of by Cleopatra. It's about the last good meeting that Herod and Cleopatra had at that point that he became arch enemy. He went on to Rome, where he was fairly good friends with Mark Antony and also Octavian, who later becomes Caesar Augustus. With their support, he is announced or proclaimed king of Judah which is kind of an interesting situation. Here, this Hasmonean Antigonus is sitting on the throne in Jerusalem in control of the country, and Herod is in Rome being appointed as king of Judah by the Romans. So he returned then in 40 BC to try to actually claim the territory. He was actually made king of the territory before he ruled over it. He was very successful in gaining support among his army, and of course he was helped out by the Romans. So by 37 BC, Herod was firmly in control of Jerusalem, although he had to actually lay siege to Jerusalem. And that is one of the reasons that Herod was never very popular. He did force himself on the Jews in Palestine at that point. He was not their first choice as a ruler, but because he was so loyal to Rome, the Romans backed him. Again, from the viewpoint of the conservative Jewish community, they saw Herod, although Herod was a Jew, it was only because his family had converted to Judaism during the Maccabean period. So basically, he was from Edomite stock, just as conservative Jews considered the Samaritans to be religiously unfit to be called Jews. Herod was considered in the same light. He was considered an outsider. He was only in the position of king because of his political ambitions, not because of his for the Jewish community. In fact, Herod did give a lot of support to the temple in Jerusalem. We'll talk about that in more detail next time. But in 18 BC, actually 22 BC, between 18 and 22, he started rebuilding the temple on a much grander scale than it had ever been built before. The temple and the platform was roughly completed probably by about 9 BC, or 9 AD, although work on the temple area continued and wasn't completed until about 63 BC, so long after the time of Herod's death.
So it should read 80.
80. 80. Okay, yeah.
Why would Cleopatra and Herod
Cleopatra was trying to, she had ideas of expanding the Egyptian Empire to its former glory, which of course meant dominating Syria, Palestine, moving up to the north. As you probably know, Cleopatra and Mark Antony were lovers. Again, not the only lovers she had. She, in fact, at one point did try to seduce Herod, or at least Herod says that she probably seduced him. It's a funny thing because Herod and Mark Antony were very good friends, and Mark Antony was supporting Herod because he was evidently a very brilliant fellow and did secure this eastern frontier for Rome. So Cleopatra was trying to influence Mark Antony constantly, put pressure on Herod to give territory to her. In fact, she did, by means of Mark Antony, get Jericho and part of the southern coast and part of the Syrian coast. So there's an interesting triangle there between the three of them, Cleopatra, Mark Antony, and she did, in fact, come to Jerusalem at one point to try to press her claims to territory, but she had rightfully belonged to the older Herod at that time. Considered killing her, but decided not to. One other interesting thing she pointed out with this little chart. Certainly in the Bible, Herod has a very bad reputation. And as you read the New Testament, you should realize it may be very clear to you that the name Herod is repeated often. There's not simply one Herod mentioned in the New Testament. There are many different Herods. The Herod that's alive at the time of the birth of Jesus is Herod the Great. We know that Herod the Great died in 4 BC, and this Patricia was raising a question a couple of weeks ago about the chronology, how do you establish chronology? This is a good example, an interesting thing, at least if the biblical account in, what is it, Matthew, is correct. Jesus is born before the death of Herod, and the wise men come and talk to Herod, so they see the child, and so forth. And Herod orders the slaughter of all the male children under 2 years of age. Okay, if that's Herod the Great, and Herod the Great died in 4 BC, then Jesus must have been born before 0 AD. Again, this gets into a lot of calendar complications, but that's one example we have to use 0 as being the time of the death of the birth of Christ, but it was at least as early as 4 BC. Some people would say it's as early as 7 or 8 BC.
Cross the corner.
Right. So again, biblical text indicates that Herod was a pretty ruthless fellow. There's a lot of other, what's that?
The Romans liked him.
Well, the Romans liked him because he was a strong, powerful leader. But, in fact, if you talk about the Romans liking him, quickly relate to one thing. Herod, because he was a little paranoid, probably with good reason, there were a number of people who were out to get him, who were out to replace him. And a number of those people were in his family. But he killed one of his wives, a woman Hasmonean extraction. Then Hasmoneans were against Herod. They were batting him constantly. Herod says it was because she was having amorous affairs. It was probably the cause of some sort of conspiracy against him. It was 7 BC, so about 3 years before Herod died, he had two of his sons executed or strangled because of their plotting against him. The day, just before his death, it was, I think, 5 days before he died, he was telling me that he may be around sickness, and I don't know exactly, there's several different theories.
How could that be? Because sickness didn't exist in, as far as the rules of 1500, it didn't be sickness. We don't care what the syphilis idea is.
Is that, are you sure about that?
Yeah. Syphilis is a North American Indian disease. Yes.
I don't know.
Yes.
We've got a human osteologist in the back there.
I'm not sure if that's a good one.
Well, 1500 AD. I didn't cut it. Well, then, I've certainly been misinformed at Vanderbilt University, then. Medical department.
It's carried over. It's very strange about the North American age. It was the only disease that, right, the only disease that the North American age was very wrong. Because it didn't have any external sources of contagion in the colony. So it's probably one of the only diseases that the North American age had.
It's syphilis. Well, syphilis, right.
Yes, they but they carried it from the origins of human civilization.
Well, I'm proud to say I don't know anything about it. But see, well, let's talk about all kinds of things.
It went to the Spanish court, and I couldn't think of a more deserving bunch.
Anyway, just to finish up with this thing with Herod. 5 days before he died, from whatever he died from, he was sitting languishing in Jericho. He heard about another plot that another one of his sons had been engaged in, and so he sent the order out to have that other son executed. Although the Romans always supported Herod very strongly, one of my favorite quotes comes from Octavian, who is Caesar Augustus, who is the Caesar during the time of Herod. And although he supported Herod strongly, he said at one point during all these executions, "I had rather be Herod's pig than Herod's son." He sums up the attitude of the Romans towards Herod. He's a good guy to have in power, but he's not necessarily on that spot. Okay, we better stop for the evening.